session number 17896, reel 3.
Am I waffling too much?
Not a bit, no. Right, this is General Purdon, reel 2. So now we've got to Colditz.
Yep.
Being in sequence, where all the bad boys went. Mm. And that was virtually unescapable from, presumably.
Well, it was damn difficult to get out of. A very great friend of mine who died a few months ago, called Billy Stevens, who was at Saint-Nazaire with me, commanding one of the lots of MLs. Billy got escaped several times from Marlag, and then he got sent to Colditz. 7 weeks later, he was in Switzerland. He was an Ulsterman like me, a wonderful guy. And so, but most of us, sadly, was bloody hard to get out of. French got few people out, we got a few people out. But, Dutch got a few people out, because of course they could speak fluent German. It was very bloody hard. But the only thing was that you had to keep on trying. And then towards the end of the war, you know, with the last couple of months, 2 or 3 months really, our senior British officer, Willie Todd, said to us, look, there's no point in, you know, we're going to be liberated any moment now, and if you do get out, you're very likely to be killed by the Germans. So there's not much point. You'll get home quicker by staying. But the escape attempts were still going on up to within a few months of the end of the war. And everyone, at Colditz, really, everyone helped. I mean, you knew that.
Because the whole thing was, it was a bad boys' academy, therefore you had the most expert escapers. All
that's right. Well, I think so. I mean, I've no doubt there were more expert escapers in other places, but Colditz has been given a terrific write-up, and I'm sure people who weren't there probably hate the Colditzians. But we were a very tight-knit family, really. I mean, we still meet every year, the survivors of Colditz. In fact, on the 16th of April, there is which was the anniversary of our liberation, there's a lunch up at the Army and Navy Club for the survivors. No, everyone was all out to help everyone else there.
What were your relations with the Commandant? Were they?
Well, you hardly ever, quite honestly, oh, very correct, yes. One hardly ever saw him. I mean, he occasionally came in. He had a little twit of a second in command, little round cock sparrow, wore a cloak, who was a pompous little fart, and I refused to salute him. And that was, that annoyed him, but we hardly ever saw the Commandant, but he was very correct.
Did you get any people who were repatriated for medical reasons? Or?
Yes, there was a chap called Edmund Hannay who feigned madness for about a year, and he got back, and then a friend of mine who was captured at Saint-Nazaire called Stuart Chance-Semple, he got back. He was bloody badly wounded. He has virtually had his kneecap shot off. Stewie got back that way. Mickey Wynne, who is now Lord Newborough, who lost an eye at Saint-Nazaire, he got repatriated as well. It may be that he escaped from the hospital he went to, but I think he was repatriated. Not very many.
So the day came when the American forces reached Colditz.
Yes.
You can remember.
Yes, well, we had a battle fought over us, virtually. I mean, there were shells bursting in the courtyard and that sort of thing. And then the next thing we knew was the door or the gate into the courtyard sort of edging open and a GI helmet looking in, and then 3 GIs came in. Of course, they were absolutely surrounded by everyone. And that was that. The liberators were there.
What was the first thing you did when you were liberated?
Well, Dick and I went and went down into the town and connected up with the Americans, because we both said we really couldn't go back home without, you know, firing a shot. So we asked if we could join them. And so I joined, Dick and I joined an American platoon, and we were posted to a section commanded by a Mexican corporal. And then we went off on their sort of fighting I can't remember how long we did it, actually, but it certainly made us both feel good. And the only thing that didn't make us feel good was we liberated, or they liberated, a Hungarian Jew concentration camp. And I think I'm right in saying the SS had killed everyone in it, they thought, but there were four survivors, and I'll never forget what they looked like, you know. Really, all you saw were two enormous eyes in each emaciated face staring at you.
I think no one could believe that human beings could be reduced to such terrible...
This is why I'm afraid I'm not a great, you know, one who wants to go in to Europe and so on. I just do not trust the Germans. I never will trust them. I know there's some really good ones. I've got a friend, really good friend, but as a race, I don't bloody well trust them, and no good them saying they didn't know what was going on. They bloody well did.
When you joined up with the American forces, I mean, you had your uniforms, presumably.
We were both wearing battle dress.
Yes. Now, you've been inside, if I can use the word, for 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, your clothes must have got pretty tatty by that time. Did you get any fresh uniforms or clothing through the Red Cross?
I think we must have done. Honestly,
stuff like that, being basic.
Yes. We got I think I got the odd parcel from my parents. With underwear. I honestly can't remember. We must have had, because we must have had more than one suit of battle dress. Yeah, we must have had. I still had my commando boots, and so had Dick, because they were wonderful. They had special soles and so on, and I absolutely loved them, and I went back home. In fact, I don't know where they are. They're probably in my kit somewhere still.
And so once you'd... been released, presumably you were sent back down the line and flown home, were you?
Yes, we were. There was a convoy of trucks, and we heard it while this American unit said, you know, you boys are going back to England. And so we went back to Colditz, and as we were there, we were formed up, and we all walked out. And Dick left my side for a moment and came back, and he'd stolen the keys of Colditz. Dick's dead now, but I've got the keys upstairs to Colditz Castle, which I'm going to put in our regimental museum. But and then we went down, and the convoy of trucks all appeared to be driven by enormous Negroes, each of whom appeared to have a bottle of liqueur, something or other, beside him on the seat, and all smoking cigars. And they drove us off to a place called, I think, Enshada. And there we saw a complete American artillery brigade shelling the town. And there was an airfield there, or a grass airfield. And there were Dakota aircraft, C-47s. And we just got into them and flew home. And we landed somewhere near Aylesbury. And I know when we landed there were a lot of nice WVS ladies there. And there were some chaps who puffed DDT powder, I think, up our battle dress sleeves and up our trouser legs. And then they took us to a transit camp, and they said, you're spending the night here. Well, I think most people did, but I was buggered if I was going to spend the night there, having, you know, and Patricia was up in Scotland, and
you're
I wanted to see her, and I wanted to see my parents. So Dick wanted to see his wife, so I said, okay, we're not going to spend the night here, we're going home. And so Rifleman McGuinness in my regiment, who I'd known before, was on the staff there, and he kit us out with green berries and all the rest of the stuff. And we just walked out, and I don't know how we got a warrant from someone for the next day, I think, but anyway, we used those warrants, and we got back home. And that was in April, and that would have been April the 16th, I suppose. And by the beginning of May, I was adjutant of our 1st Battalion, 6th Airborne Division.
You'd been away from your family and your fiancé and so on for over 3 years.
Yeah.
Did you have difficulty adjusting when you got back? All the pressures of war, the alertness you had to have?
No. I don't think so. We had a lot of parties in London with chums. Patricia and I'd go up, and Peggy and Dick, and we used to dance at Hatchett's and go to the Café Royal and have a bottle of Pim behind the bar there, and had a, spent a hell of a lot of money, probably. No way. I mean, this is what makes me laugh about this counselling that seems to go on now. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands, probably millions, of allied people. They didn't bloody well need counselling. We'd have been disgusted with ourselves. And no, I think one or two chaps found it a bit difficult getting their diet right, you know, because one thing one found was rich food was no good at all. Your stomach rather rejected rich food, and also food in large quantities, quite frankly. Although I don't ever think that... I mean, I had been bloody hungry at times, but not as hungry as all that. And now, I found a really... Trish may tell you differently, but I didn't think I had much difficulty in readjusting at all. And this is one of the reasons I want to get back to the war as quickly as I could before it was over. But unfortunately... I joined 6th Airborne Division as adjutant, and they blew the whistle. But then we were going out to Burma after that.
Now, I just asked this question because I, 3 years of being away from all the important things in family life.
Yes.
And so on.
Yeah.
And I just, really being a bit of a devil's advocate here, you said there were a lot of parties.
Yeah.
Did you use alcohol as a kind of smokescreen to get around these problems?
Or no, not at all. I always was a party chap. You asked Patricia. I was always, good God, no, not a bit. I think the fact that we were so keen on escaping, that you were, in a way, doing things that got the adrenaline going and kept the adrenaline going most of the time. You know, I think if I'd been sitting on my backside working to become a lawyer or a priest or something, I might have felt differently. But the fact that we were always trying to escape, and when you did escape, you see, it was, you knew bloody well that you could easily be shot, not only during your breakout, but you could be shot at any time, really, you know, especially if you were near somewhere you shouldn't have been. So, I found absolutely not that
I... You were at a stage in life where it was probably easier to adjust than,
yeah,
for instance, if you were married.
Yes.
And when you went off in 42, you,
yeah,
left two small children behind and came,
yeah,
back to find them teenagers.
Yes, I quite agree, absolutely.
The relationship, yeah, then would have been difficult.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But Patricia and I mean, it was as if we were married because, you know, when we met each other, we were so lucky because we knew bloody well that, you know, that it was only each of us and there was no one else in the world. And so I always felt that I was married to her and she always felt she was married to me. And we couldn't get to each other quick enough. I mean, she was in the ATS as a corporal and she packed up, she just left her unit when she heard I was back. And she heard Douglas Bader was back, you see, and my father knew Douglas Bader. And Tish saw this in the papers. And she just got straight on the train from where she was in Scotland and came straight down to my parents' home. I met her at Euston, actually, and then I brought her down there. But, I mean, she was on her way. I rang her up as soon as I got, was able to get her telephone.
Bader was in Colditz with you?
Yes, he was, yeah. Great chap.
Mm. Now, once you got back, you presumably you had leave, and then you rejoined your regiment.
Yeah.
And was that when it became part of 6th Airborne?
No, it had been part of 6th Airborne.
Yeah,
they had been 6th Airborne. They landed on D-Day, you know, by glider. They were a glider-borne battalion. And then they, when they were withdrawn, they then were brought in again to fight in the Ardennes. Then they did the Rhine crossing, and they ended up at Wismar on the Baltic. And then they'd been brought home to regroup. And if the war had gone on, we'd have gone back to Germany, I understood. And then we were told, OK, well, you're now going to Southeast Asia, you're going to Burma. So, and then, of course, luckily for us, they dropped the atomic bombs. And that spared the lives of millions of Allied servicemen, and no doubt spared the lives of a lot of Japanese.
And did you have to qualify as a parachutist once?
No.
You never got your red berry?
No, we always had a red berry, but we were the air landing brigade.
Uh-huh.
So we did not parachute.
That's what
we did. We did our, yeah, you got a badge, you did your glider trips, and you wore a funny little badge of a glider. No, you didn't have to. I'd love to have done my parachute jumps, but we weren't a parachute battalion.
So, came the end of the war.
Yes.
And you were part of 6th Air Force.
Yes.
What was your next move?
Palestine. In September, we went out to... we landed at Haifa, and we went to Gaza. And we were in a camp at Gaza, which was literally... It was a tented camp apart from the headquarters offices, the battalion headquarters offices, and the other ranks dining room, dining hall, and I think the officers' mess. And then we were at Gaza, patrolling from there. And then from Gaza we went to Lida, and we guarded the airport at Lida and patrolled the railway lines and so on round there. And then from Lida, we went to Camp 22 at Nathania. And we were at Camp 22, and we really got involved in quite a lot of internal security work there, because the Israelis were blowing up police stations and blowing up railway lines, and they were landing their immigrant ships, you know, beaching them, and we had to round up the illegal immigrants. And then we had trouble in Tel Aviv when the Israelis, again, in Tel Aviv, they attacked government offices. We were in there for about a week. My battalion was under command of 2 para brigade, again, restoring law and order. And then we moved to Jerusalem. And at that stage, my colonel, who was one of my dearest friends, told me he was leaving to command a para battalion, and he said to me, "Do you want to stay on as adjutant with my successor?" And his successor was a man for whom I had no respect at all, and so I said no, and he said, "Well, in that case, I would like you to go back and command the regimental company at the Irish Group ITC in Omagh, County Tyrone." So I came home in May 1946, and Patricia and I then moved over, and for a year I commanded the company there.
Sorry, where was this?
Omagh, County Tyrone, the Irish Group Infantry Training Centre. Yeah. And then after that, they reformed the Territorial Army in Northern Ireland, and we formed a battalion called the 6th Battalion, Royal Ulster Rifles, and I was then its adjutant. I was the first adjutant until 1949.
Going back to Palestine,
yes.
I'm interested in a bit more on the details.
Yes.
Of what you had to do there.
Yes.
Now, this was a very different kind of military activity.
Absolutely.
What sort of training did you have for it?
The briefing was to be absolutely impartial, which I can put my hand on my heart and say we were. In fact, if anything, we felt so sorry for the Arabs. They were completely outclassed by the Jews, who most of whom had served in either the Russian army, the British army, American army, were highly skilled, very intelligent people. And one felt tremendous sympathy for them. Having been myself into a Jewish concentration camp, I mean, God almighty, and... you know, and liking to think that one attempts to be a Christian. On the other hand, the Arabs, poor old things, were utterly bewildered. You know, they didn't know what the hell was going on, and they got no one to really lead them. So our trouble all came from the Jews. And what they would do was that there was a railway line, you see, which went to Egypt. And all the biblical names like Beersheba and so on, you know, they went through. And they would blow up the railway line, or they would blow up water reservoirs, you know, or they would crater roads. And on occasion, they would take on Palestine police stations. And so we got involved in that. One went out on patrol. Oh, yes, of course. when they, for a week, Tel Aviv was in a bloody awful state. And again, we went in and we quelled all that. I mean, one parachute battalion, the commanding officer, a chap called Reggie, no, I can't remember his name, I think it was Hewitson, but he shot himself personally three ringleaders who were inciting the crowd. And after that, there was no trouble from them at all. But that was minimum force, quite frankly, because instead of shooting everyone, like I think some countries might have shot all sorts of people, he picked out the ringleaders. But there were three different occasions when he personally, as commanding officer, because he didn't want any of his men to be victimized, and he shot them personally with his rifle. But we were patrolling at night, patrolling at day. We had armored cars with us as well, patrolling through the streets.
Because the three Jewish terrorist organizations were a ruthless lot.
Yes, yes. Well, the Haganah, the Irgun Zwei Leumi, and the Stern Gang.
Stern Gang, yeah.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, very... I mean, you really felt you were earning your money out there.
Were you there when the two sergeants were hanged?
No, I'm glad to say I wasn't. No. That would have... I'm glad they weren't members of my regiment, because I wouldn't answer for Irish soldiers if that happened.
It was a situation you were glad to leave, was it?
I was terribly sorry to leave my regiment, which was my family. No, I wasn't particularly glad to leave. What I was glad was to get back to Patricia. But that was, and to see my parents, of course. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, really.
Because the mandate was a pretty thankless job.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, on my various RMVR cruises, I'd come across people on the mess deck who'd run the anti-immigrant vote.
Yes, yeah.
And he was saying there that they all wore cricket boxes.
Yes.
After the first interception, because the women had steel knitting needles, and as soon as the boarding party came over, they'd ignore a pretty girl at the gangplank who squatted down.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're all pretty well.
Well, we were lucky. We never had to wear boxes.
No,
Well, they were terribly tough, the women. I mean, when I was stoned, I was stoned by a woman, or by women, and they had their skirts rolled up, and the thighs were like a Olympic shot putter, you know. They were really tough. I don't remember seeing any pretty ones among the ones that were chucking stones at us. But luckily one was wearing Denison smocks, and they rather sort of absorbed the impact.
Did you have to live in secure conditions while you were
Yes.
there? You couldn't wander around in civvies in the town off duty?
No, I don't think you could. I went out shooting with my CO to the Hule Marshes. I don't know whether I wore... The only photograph I've got of it were both wearing Denison smock jackets, but no hats, I suppose, no berries. No, there was no question, I don't think, of people wandering around civvies. I don't think there was. Certainly, we didn't.
And you left when, about 47?
46.
46, so yeah. That's 2 years.
We got there in 45, and yeah. Mm.
So you came back?
Yes.
Home to the depot, did you?
No, I came back and I went to Omagh, County Tyrone, to the Irish Group Infantry Training Centre, where there was a headquarter company and then a Royal Inniskilling Fusilier Company, a Royal Ulster Rifle Company and a Royal Irish Fusilier Company. And I was made a major and given command of the Ulster Rifle Company. And I commanded that for a year. And then the Territorial Army reformed in Northern Ireland, and I was only a temporary major anyway, and I handed over my company, and I was appointed adjutant of the 6th Battalion, which I did for 2 years, based in Belfast, but without stations in various Irish county towns.
The thing I'm curious about, and this question arose in my mind when I read your book, a lot of very distinguished Irish regiments. I mean, there's your own, the Inniskilling,
yes. The Irish Fusiliers.
The 5th Inniskilling Dragoon Guards,
yes.
The Royal Irish Fusiliers,
yeah.
And
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
One hears a lot about sectarianism these days.
Yeah.
How was there much in those days? Was there
none.
A specific Catholic regiment?
No.
None.
My regiment recruited, I'll give you mine as an example, just the same as the Skins and the Fogs. My regiment recruited both sides of the border. At one stage, we had 50% south, 50% north. I would say we had 50% Roman Catholics, 50% Protestants. And there was, we never discussed politics, we never discussed religion, unless people were joking. For example, our pipe band would play, say, the Sash Me Father War, and everyone would cheer. Immediately afterwards, they'd play the Wearing of the Green, and everyone would cheer again. We all sang rebel songs at guest nights and parties and so on. I remember in the 6th Battalion, a fellow called Rifleman Barr, who was one of my drummers, coming up to me and saying, "You know, sir, I'm so glad I joined the TA, because no one wants to know what my religion is. And if they did know, they couldn't care less." And do you know that there on the 12th of July, and on whatever day the Roman Catholics marched in Belfast or in Northern Ireland, I have been down to our support company at Lisburn, and I found my boys getting ready, wearing their orange sashes, being helped into them by the Roman Catholic members of support company, and vice versa. When it came to August and Black Sunday, whatever the hell they called it, the Protestants were there helping these chaps on with their green sashes. We had no sectarianism at all. It wouldn't have been allowed, and B, we weren't interested.
Do you know what the situation is now? I mean, you're in touch with your regiment, presumably.
Well, my son is the deputy commander of 3 Brigade in Armagh, and he is an Irish Guardsman, and he, I think, is fairly cynical about the talks, and I know from my own regiment, because I was over there last month, which is now the Royal Irish Regiment, because we've all been absorbed into that, that the IRA are continuing dummy runs of ambushes and reconnaissances and so on. I mean, they're still training.
Getting their hands in, yeah.
Yeah. I tried to get back there when I left the army. The CGS at the time, General Sir Peter Hunt, recommended me to be chief constable. Because I couldn't bear to be out of the army. When I found I had to be out, he said to me, well, how would you like to be chief constable over there? And I said, well, I'd love to. And he recommended me. But they very sensibly took a professional policeman called Newman, and who was extremely good. But the point of view of sectarianism and so on, it just doesn't come into it as far as the army is concerned.
I want to move on to your next...